Welcome to Behind the Headlines, your Friday morning Utah news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard all over the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, Utah lawmakers say that they will try once again to abolish the death penalty, but a county prosecutor says he's already done with it. Developers say that they want to fix Utah Lake by building massive islands on it, but scientists say the project would do more harm than good. And in a newly surfaced video, Senate President Stuart Adams says Utah jazz star Donovan Mitchell needs educating on critical race theory. Joining me for this conversation, all via Zoom, we've got Salt Lake Tribune reporter Brian Maffley. Hey, Brian, thanks for being here.
Hi, Roger. It's good to be here. I wish we were in the studio.
I wish you guys were as well. Reporter Jessica Miller. Good morning, Jessica.
Good morning.
And Tribune editorial page editor and columnist George Pyle. Welcome, George.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. Later in the show, we will hear from Tribune political correspondent Brian Schott as well on those comments from Senate President Stuart Adams. Be sure to stick around for that. You can join us with your questions and comments over in the Twitter sphere. Our handle is at KCPW, and we would love to have you weigh in on the topics that we are tackling today on the show. Jessica Miller, we will start with the death penalty. A couple of stories tied to this topic, both of which broke on the same day. Lawmakers will give, doing away with capital punishment another go. And then, meanwhile, a county attorney says that he's never going to pursue the death penalty again. Before we delve deeper into each of these, I have to ask, was the timing of these two stories coincidental, or was there some coordination between, these parties happening, between lawmakers and Utah County Attorney David Levitt?
It actually was kind of a coincidence. The case that David Levitt was talking about when he said he would stop seeking the death penalty, it's in a certain point in the court process now. And if he was going to pull the death penalty off the table, now would have been the time to do it. So it actually was quite the coincidence that both of these announcements came on the same day.
Okay, well let's zoom out to that to the bigger level and go to the state and how they're trying to do away with this. Jessica, you have covered previous efforts, I know, to get rid of the death penalty in Utah, and this is going to be just the latest attempt. Who is behind this latest push?
So this is the third time in recent years that a bill will be brought to abolish the death penalty. It's always a different lawmaker every time that has sponsored this. This year, it's Lowry Snow and Dan McKay. They've announced that they'll bring a bill to abolish the death penalty. What's different this year is they are proposing an alternative sentence that's higher, that instead prosecutors, instead of life without parole or the death penalty, they could argue that a 45-year to life sentence is warranted. So their proposal is getting rid of the death penalty, but adding another sentencing option for prosecutors as they, negotiate these cases, because most of the time, most of these cases are ending in plea deals. It's pretty rare for them to actually go to trial.
Right. The death sentence is often used as kind of a bargaining chip, right? Like this is how bad it could get. You're going to plea, something lesser than that and admit to your crimes as a result. There's also the fact that that even when people are sentenced to death, it takes quite a long time. I can't remember the average amount of time, Jessica, that it takes for a person, for that sentence to be carried out in the United States. But it's quite a while, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you think about the extra effort on the onset. I mean, someone who is facing the death penalty probably has like four public defenders, maybe, compared to like one. If it was a regular case, there's probably four times as many prosecutors on this case. And then once they get a conviction, you're looking at least 30 years of appeals in state court and in federal court. So it's a really ineffective tool at this point. And what we've seen, I mean, the last time someone got sentenced to the death penalty in Utah, it was in 2008, and that person ended up dying in prison of natural causes. So it's taking so long that most of these men who've been convicted in Utah, at least, are dying of natural causes, and they're not actually dying from the state killing them.
And then given the amount of prosecutors that you just described assigned to the case, it sounds like an expensive proposition as well. Representative Snow, Lowry Snow, who you said is behind this push, he cited the story of a famous, murder trial and death sentence. A death sentence that was never carried out as an example of why this doesn't make sense anymore. Ron Lafferty was sentenced to death, but instead, just like you described, he was someone who waited on death row for a very long time and then died in prison, which, as you said, is kind of a common thing.
Right. And he was the closest inmate to kind of going down that line of the 30 years of appeals. He was kind of the next in line to actually face the death penalty. But I remember looking, they released like a recent mugshot of him before he died, and he looked very, very old and very frail, very sick. So he, was not doing well as these appeals processes were playing out. And then he ended up dying of natural causes after, I think it was at least 30 years. It might have been 35 years on death row.
And then we're also leaving aside, I know this wasn't necessarily in the latest reporting, but there are those incidents or there have been those, examples of evidence coming to light that would have proved someone's innocence or at least called into question their trial after that person has been executed. And I know that there are groups that work on exonerating people. Sometimes that doesn't come in time, I guess.
Right.
Go ahead. Yeah.
I was saying that's one of the biggest criticisms of the death penalty. One is that it's so expensive, and two is, the criminal justice system is flawed. It is not a perfect system. And when you're making literally life and death decisions like that, you're holding it up in a framework that is flawed, and it does get stuff wrong.
There is, I want to get to the story of David Levitt in Utah County and also some criticism from people who are seeking justice and want to see the death penalty preserved. But just before we get there, let's stay at the state level. And I want to ask, what has prevented the prior attempts of trying to abolish the death penalty in Utah? What stopped that from passing? And is there any reason to believe, that this time around, this push is going to be more successful than those previous attempts?
Previously, I think it's really hard for legislators when, on paper, this seems like a great idea to abolish it. It's so expensive. It just doesn't match a lot of conservative values, pro-life, things like that. But then they go into these, committee hearings, and there are family members who want this option when something horrendous has happened to their family members, and they, are upset and they're crying, and they say, this is the only way that we feel like we can get justice for our loved ones. And so I think that there's so much emotion tied to this topic was a big reason why it's failed in the past. And like I said, this year is a little bit different because they're offering this alternative of a 45 year to life sentence. So I don't know if that will be enough to kind of feel like everybody wins, that there's the bargaining chip that prosecutors want, that, people whose loved ones have been killed have that assurance that, it's very unlikely that this person will ever be set free again. So it'll be interesting to see how that new angle will play out at the session this year.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's turn to David Levitt then in Utah County, who isn't going to wait for the legislative session. He says, as you said, he announced, that same day earlier this week that he won't ever again, himself pursue the death penalty. And he, as I remember from your reporting, he also cited a very specific case. I guess, tell us about Levitt's rationale for going the route that he's going.
Right. So there's a case that he's been actively prosecuting for the last 2 years, that 2 years ago, he did declare that he was going to seek the death penalty. And it's, a pretty heinous case where a man is accused of killing two teenagers and dropping their bodies in a mine shaft. It was just a horrendous crime. Even 2 years ago, when David Levitt made his announcement, you could tell he felt very conflicted about this. He talked about how prosecutors have too much power and how he was letting the jury decide, whether this man lived or died. So he kind of, pushed off of the responsibility to a jury, let the people decide. And now he says that he's changed his position and that it's too costly and it doesn't deter crime. And so he made the decision to file court papers that essentially says he'll no longer seek the death penalty in that case. And he's publicly said that he won't seek the death penalty in any other case either.
Hmm. This is something that has not been received well, at least by some members of the family of the victims in that exact case, right, Jessica?
Correct. Yeah, the family in that case, they were supportive of David seeking the death penalty initially, and the aunt, one of the victims, called him a coward, that he was going back on his word. And you know, we've also seen pushback from some, you know, policing groups like the Fraternal Order of Police. One of their high-ranking members expressed concern that, you know, there was a cop that was killed in Utah County, and apparently the county attorney had promised to seek the death penalty in that case, and now he's saying he won't anymore. And so there are a lot of people who still believe that the death penalty has value and find it very personal that he is not going to seek it any longer.
It's interesting, though, the value there kind of diminishes when the average time, and I just looked it up in your article, that that someone is on death row in the United States, having been sentenced to death, is 22 years, meaning that's that could be a life sentence for a lot of people anyway. But yeah, I guess that, you know, it's just one of the things to consider. I want to, Jessica, bring in George Pyle, our editorial voice on the show and columnist. He's the editorial page editor with the Salt Lake Tribune. And George, this is one of those issues where, you know, it feels like it's hard to have any nuance. It's, you know, for or against. And I guess I'll just ask for your thoughts on the renewed efforts to do away with the death penalty in Utah. And then also, yeah, this Utah County Attorney David Levitt's decision not to pursue it himself.
Well, yeah, Representative Snow spoke with the editorial board a few days ago when they announced this. And it was interesting to me that this is increasingly becoming the conservative position. I mean, Representative Snow and Senator McKay, no flaming liberals they, and they are leading this effort to abolish the death penalty because they've decided it doesn't fit with conservative values. Conservative values warn of government overreach, of giving the government too much power, of giving the government too much discretion. Representative Snow mentioned that whether a particular case would result in a death penalty is too random. It would depend on the temperament of the judge, the attitude, the decisions made by the prosecutor, the skill and the abilities of the defense attorney, the views of the jury. Whether the death penalty was practically on the table would depend to somewhat on the zip code of where the crime was committed. And that's not fair. That's not justice. And he also was talking about the fact that under current law, under understanding United States Supreme Court precedent, you have to have, when the ultimate penalty, when the one that you can't take back by issuing the pardon afterwards is on the table, then the Supreme Court requires all these levels of appeals. And so if you're someone who has lost a loved one to the crime of murder, and instead of having somebody sentenced to 45 years to life or life without parole, and then it's over, when the death penalty is involved, you're dealing with hearings and appeals and back to court and sentencing and resentencing, and an execution date is set and then canceled and then reset. And so the people who are either survivors are left in this horrible bumper car situation where they just have to keep reliving it and reliving it. And that was part of the motivation for Lowry Snow saying he had spoken to relatives who have been in this position and felt like the system had promised them an execution. And when it didn't happen, they felt like they'd been lied to. Huh. And so now if you don't have the death penalty, you're not going to tell that lie anymore.
Interesting. I'm wondering, you know, you said Representative Snow and Senator McKay, no flaming liberals, they, as you put it in almost a poetic verse there, George. I'm wondering, Jessica, if either of those two, I don't know if you had this in your article, but, you know, if they had a change of heart on this, meaning did they describe a conversion to their opposition to the death penalty, whereas before they had been in favor of it? Or was it simply, I don't know. Can you answer that question, I guess?
I do believe Representative Snow said that he was once a supporter. And that was the same thing, you know, 2 or 3 years ago when the bill sponsor then, Gage Froer, he said the same thing. You know, he was a conservative who once believed in the death penalty and now does not. And so I think we've been seeing this shift in an outlook with the death penalty and conservative Republicans over these last couple of years.
And then just going back to the David Levitt story, I'm wondering if other prosecutors might follow suit here, Jessica. I mean, he's making this decision of his own accord. I'm not going to pursue this. How about other prosecutors around the state?
You know, that's my big question also. You know, David Levitt is the Utah County Attorney, which, you know, is a very large county. And he's the first elected prosecutor to say this. And so I think the question is will the rest follow? And so far, the county prosecutors and the district attorney I've spoken with are pretty tight-lipped about it. They say, like, there's more to come. So I think that will be interesting to see whether they support the legislation or whether they come out more strongly like David Levitt has and just declare on their own that, you know, they're using their prosecutorial discretion to no longer seek the death penalty.
Interesting. George Pyle, go ahead. I mean, I wanted to ask you a final question, which is...
I think it's worthy of note that you have all these people who are coming around on this issue. And of course, now that they're coming to agree with me, I describe them as evolving. But but the fact is, changing your mind, changing your position in American politics is not always a winning suit. And I mean, maybe not in Dutch politics or German politics either, but in American politics particularly, if you take one position and then you take a different position, you get accused of being a flip-flopper. You get accused of betrayal. You get accused of being a Republican or a Democrat in name only. You're really opening yourself up to all kinds of criticism and attacks. So the fact that all these elected officials are saying, you know what, I'm following John Maynard Keynes here. When the facts change, I change my opinion. And that takes some guts.
And do you think, George, that in you know, the 2022 session, that enough of the legislature will have the you know, what you would describe as guts to make this actually happen in Utah?
I think the chances are very good. The sponsors have lined up their arguments and are obviously Republican conservatives in good standing. They have some families of victims who are going to support them on this. And before, I mean, it would pass the Senate and die at the last minute in the House. It's come close before. It's not like it's been crushed before. It's come close. So I'm not going to predict what the Utah legislature does, but the chances are good.
All right. George Pyle with some predictions there. Jessica Miller, thank you very much for your reporting on both of these stories and for filling us in. We're going to head to our first break in the show. And then when we come back, the grandiose dreams that some developers have for Utah Lake. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be back in just a minute.
This week in This American Life, one of our producers, Parker, grew up in Baltimore like I did, and she explained to me that she and other black kids of her generation were terrified going to this history museum called the Great Blacks and Wax. This week, Parker goes back.
I'm sorry, I just got distracted by them trying to shove the guy in the oven. Sorry.
What? What?
No, that's Underground Railroad. That's a fake oven.
Oh, okay.
What's suitable for children this week?
Saturday morning at 10 here on Utah Public Radio.
For women, having a seat at the table does not mean having a voice. When women speak, they are interrupted more, listened to less, and perceived as less authoritative than men. I'm Dr. Susan Madsen, founding director of the Utah Women in Leadership Project. In our next podcast episode, we'll explore what it takes for women to be heard. Listen in September at utwomen.org.
And welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough. I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Salt Lake Tribune reporters Brian Maffley and Jessica Miller, and by editorial page editor and columnist George Pyle. It's our live Friday morning Utah News Review, and you can join us with your questions and comments by tweeting them to @KCPW. Brian Maffley, to a story now that I have to admit that I keep just sort of expecting, you know, to fizzle out in a way, but it hasn't done that. This is the story that some developers want to put islands in Utah Lake. And what they're saying now, and maybe they've been saying it always, I don't know, but they're saying that that these islands will be environmentally beneficial to the lake. First off, who are we talking about here? Who are these developers? And then remind us the sort of broad strokes of their proposal for these islands.
Yeah, this goes back about 4 years, Roger. The developers are these brothers named Todd and Ben Parker. They started a company called Lake Restoration Solutions a few years back, and put forward a proposal to, quote unquote, solve the environmental problems of Utah Lake. It's one of the largest freshwater lakes in the West. 150 square miles of surface area. It should be a natural amenity that should support a lot of wildlife and be a great place for recreation. And it's none of those things, because we've filled it with pollution, invasive species, carp. And it's just kind of like a mess. And it's been like that for decades. And so what the Parkers have proposed is dredging the sediments off the bed of the lake, the entire bed, 3 to 6 feet down, be a billion cubic yards, and then taking those sediments, which are supposedly contaminated with nutrients that have washed into the lakes and other pollutants over the years, and capture them, sequester them in these islands, up to 20,000 acres of islands. And the problem with the project is there's a lot of legal hurdles and technical hurdles that these guys have yet to explain to the public how they're going to get past. And so I was like you, Roger. I was like, when this first came out, I thought, oh, this is going to fizzle. It's so grandiose and questionable. And yet here we are 4 years later, and they're finally going to get around to submitting the documentation and permit applications with the appropriate agencies, with the Utah Department of Natural Resources on the one hand and the Federal Army Corps of Engineers on the federal side. And their new CEO, Ryan Benson, has told us that their plan in the next several weeks is to get all this documentation filed with the Army Corps. But anyway, it's been kicking around for a long time, and I think we're finally going to see some progress here.
Can I ask just what you said that they would dredge sediments from the lake, and that's what would help the lake. Meaning, the problem that needs solving on the lake, I guess, is pollution, as you said. It's the fact that there's contamination in the lake, and this dredging would supposedly fix that.
Yeah, the problems, environmental problems on the lake are multifaceted. And one of them is that the lake, certain parts of the lake are filled with nutrients that have washed in from agriculture, wastewater treatment plants, heavy industry back when Geneva was producing steel. And right, those sediments are those nutrients, mostly phosphorus, nitrogen, stuff like that, feeds these algal blooms that tend to go off every summer and fall in the eastern part of the lake. The eastern part of the lake is more vulnerable because that's where this contamination enters from, through the Provo River and Cobble and places like that. So what the thought is, well, this pollution is captured and stuck in the sediments of the lake. It's a shallow lake, and when there's wind events, it all gets stirred up and mixed into the water column. And that's where the algae can start feeding on it. And we've seen, the last several years, 30 years really, these really awful algal blooms,
right,
every July, August. It's so bad in Linden, or Provo Bay and Linda Marina that you can't even go near the water. It's just, it's discolored.
It's dangerous, right?
Yep. All sorts of toxins get released. It's one of many problems associated with the lake. So what Lake Restoration Solutions thinks they can do is dredge all this material, a billion cubic yards. Just think about a billion cubic yards, you know, over the course of many years, and put it in these tubes, and the tubes will be used to support the foundation of these islands. So how this is going to all pay for itself is now these islands will become developable real estate, and now we'll build subdivisions on them. And of course, Utah County is one of the fastest growing counties in the West, in the country, really. And so the thought is you know, a lot of wealth can be generated through developing that real estate. And if you solve the lake's environmental problems, gosh, it could be, you know, living on Utah Lake could be a great thing. It could really be an attractive place, but, you know, recreation can return to the lake, and also then hopefully the ecosystem will be restored. And of course, that's just like this dream that they have.
Sure. And Brian, but there are some experts among them, a BYU ecologist and other scientists who say that this plan, in terms of actually benefiting the lake, probably won't pan out.
Yeah, it's people like Sam Abbott of BYU, Sam Rushforth of Utah Valley University, many others. They just scoff at this idea that you can address the lakes the problems in this way. And so, you know, but of course, they haven't seen the studies that Lake Restoration Solutions has commissioned. We don't really know what they're basing their claims on. So maybe it's a little premature to dismiss these claims. Ryan, in my interviews with Ryan Benson, they said, look, we're doing these studies and the results appear to be promising that the lake's environmental problems can be addressed through dredging and island building, deepening the lake. For example, the shallow lake averaged 12 feet in depth. If you deepen the lake, you will reduce the impact of wave action on the lake bed, so there'll be less opportunity to stir up that muck. Anyone who's on Utah Lake knows how turbid the waters can get. You can barely see a foot through there. Total, complete opposite of other, big freshwater lakes in the West, where you can see, right, way like Lake Tahoe or Coeur d'Alene, you can see way down in there, and the clarity of the water is a beautiful thing. We don't have that at Utah Lake. You can't, and so there, the feeling is that by deepening the lake, you can help address some of these problems with turbidity.
Brian, now,
Ben Abbott, on the other hand, says, look, if you deepen the lake, you're actually going to worsen the algae problem.
Why would that be the case?
Because the way he's explained it is, if you deepen the lake, you create these temperature zones and you wind up with eutrophic conditions deeper in the lake, in these lower levels of the lake. And in those situations, the nutrients will become more bioavailable to the algae. That's the thinking. And this has been shown in reservoirs elsewhere in the West, where you've created these kind of artificial deep water conditions that have fed algae blooms. And we do see that on like Pine View Reservoir or Schofield Reservoir in our state of Utah, but elsewhere as well. So these are important questions that need to get answered.
Hey, Brian, I want to ask, there's a couple questions that I want to get to, and I'm worried about our time. There's a lot of, yeah. Benson says that he has financial backing, right? A lot of financial backing for this, as we've been calling it, grandiose project. What does that money look like, and where's it coming from?
Well, what he's told me is that they have about $6 billion pledged to support this project, and $6 billion is about how much they're estimating it would cost. And it's not just to build these islands; it's also to do removal of invasive fish and vegetation called Phragmites, which clogs the shores, and also do water filtration, all manner of things, but the most expensive thing, of course, is going to be the dredging. And so anyway, they've told me they've got $6 billion lined up. However, they're not in a position where they can disclose who those funders are.
If that's the case, do we know whether or not there really is that financial backing? I mean, it's just they're not in a position where they can disclose who the funders are, I guess, because of agreements.
Yeah. At this position, it's not a matter of public information. So, we can't, there's no way to confirm that. But that they have that backing, to me, says, if they say they have that backing, to me, says they're serious.
And then, Brian, the legislature has been involved in this as well, haven't they? I mean, the idea has been looked at from the state level.
Yeah, so it was the legislature 4 years ago, passed a law essentially directing the Utah Department of Natural Resources to consider this proposal and take a good look at it. So that's exactly what they did. They assembled a team of experts and have been twiddling their thumbs ever since, waiting for an application to come in with supporting materials. And so they don't really know what to say about it. There's a lot of skepticism in those agencies. And I think that's their job, especially in the Department of Environmental Quality. They'll be involved too. However, without seeing the documentation that Lake Restorations has put together, it's really hard to weigh the merits of this proposal.
I'm having a hard time. I'm going to bring George Pyle in this in a little bit, but a couple of things that strike me are that, $6 billion could do a lot to restore the lake without building, big islands in the center of it that would then bring people. Obviously, there would be environmental impacts to having people and their garbage and their sewage and the rest of it if you did that. And then also, I can't wrap my mind around how this would actually be accomplished. The dredging, what kind of machinery would it take to do what Benson is describing?
Yeah, I don't even know. This has been described as perhaps the world's largest artificial island building project ever undertaken in history. I don't know. That's a good question. How do you dredge that much material? It would be over the course of many years, obviously.
Yeah.
And in the other part of this is what Mr. Benson's been saying is that by deepening the lake and raising these islands, you've created a great deal more water storage on Utah Lake by as much as 400 to 500,000 acre feet of storage, which is huge. And so that's another one of the benefits they're touting. And so the way they described it, it's all going to pay for itself. However, there's a lot of other legal issues, too. And let's bring George into this, and I'll get to those in a second.
Sure, George, I guess I'll just ask you to, what do you see in this project, George Pyle, editorial page editor and columnist, the opinionator on the show?
Well, this, reminds me of the internet meme that pops up in so many cases where you say, oh, what could possibly go wrong? I just hope that this gets the kind of vetting that it really is going to need. This is a huge project. All kinds of unintended consequences could occur, even if the developers have the best of intentions. And I can see how it would be pretty saleable to say, we really ought to do billions of work on this lake anyway. And instead of the taxpayers paying for it, we'll pay for it and we'll get our money back and more by building islands and selling houses. And of course, if you want to get the support of the Utah legislature, all you have to do is say, I'm building houses, because that's basically the real estate industry basically controls the legislature. And so if you come along and you say, I'm going to build houses, I'm going to make money, I'm going to make places for your grandchildren to live so they don't have to move away. If the legislature has anything to say about it, that's exactly what will happen. You can only hope that this thing gets fitted. One thing they absolutely must do, in my opinion, is post a massive bond, because probably the worst thing that could happen is that this project begins and they start digging and dredging and piling. And then they say, whoops, never mind. We're broke. We're out of here. Bye. And leaves the state or the county holding the bag.
And there's other funding mechanisms that aside from just building houses, I was going to say, Brian, I know that Benson says they are seeking money, through grants from the EPA. And of course, you know, these guys would say that they're what they're doing is being visionaries where others are naysayers or whatever. But George points out some of the liabilities. Brian, we're going to have to go to a break here soon. But, you know, you also reported on a Utah Lake symposium that happened a few weeks ago. And I feel like everybody who was at that, this was at Utah Valley University, ecologists, biologists, indigenous leaders and other interested parties. I don't think any of them were on board with this project, right?
Not really. I mean, there were a couple, elected leaders who are somewhat favorable toward it, like Brady Brammer, a member of the House. I think the mayor of Vineyard was there. She seemed pretty supportive. But on the science end of it, no, there was very little enthusiasm for this project. And that symposium at UVU was organized to, you know, really publicize these concerns, both legal and scientific, about this project. And I want to clarify something that the EPA assistance that's being sought there by the companies is not for grants, but for loans, low interest loans.
Yeah. Got it. Brian, there's so much more to the story that I will direct people to in your article. We do need to head to our next break in the show. We're saving time for a final segment, a recorded segment at the end of the show. But yeah, really interesting reporting. And any final sort of comments on this? I mean, I won't ask you to predict whether or not it happens, but what are the next steps, I guess?
Well, I think we need to be aware of is what this company's asking for, which is so huge, is they're asking to privatize the entire bed of Utah Lake, which is considered quote unquote sovereign lands. It was given to the state of Utah at statehood to be managed in a public trust. We need to think long and hard about whether this kind of project is in the, you know, truly benefits the public. That's the big legal hurdle they've got to clear also. It'll get challenged in court if it's approved. And the public trust question will come to the fore.
All right. That's Brian Maffley, who is public lands and environment reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune. We need to head to our next break in the show. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio, featuring reporting from the pages of the Salt Lake Tribune. We'll be back with our underplayed stories in just a minute.
Make an appointment with Public Radio's favorite family doc in the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health. It'll be a jam-packed hour in healthy living, including this recipe for
turkey hummus sliders.
We always have a great time, so will you on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRX.
Tune in Sunday afternoon at 1 here on Utah Public Radio.
The West's relationship with water is complicated, and it's only getting more complex.
Last year was considerably dry, maybe the driest we'd seen, and now we're looking at even drier.
I think it's been described as a slow-moving train wreck.
I'm Alex Hager, reporting on the water issues that define the Western U.S. Listen for stories about the Colorado River Basin on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW. I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Brian Maffley, Jessica Miller, and George Pyle. And to save time for a recorded segment with Tribune political correspondent Brian Schott, we're going to have to turn now to our final segment, the underplayed stories of the week. And we are very low on time, but Jessica Miller, let's bring you back into kick things off. What's your pick for underplayed story of the week?
So I really enjoyed a story that Aaron Alberti did about trying to answer the question of why is it so hard to get a COVID-19 test right now?
Yeah.
So if people are experiencing that, that's a good place to turn to figure out what some of those problems are.
Excellent. Thank you for that pick, Jessica. Brian, I know you've got a pick. What is it? But you'll have to be quick. I'm sorry.
Yeah, there's a mysterious proposal to revitalize a 250-mile rail. Dilapidated rail line in Northern California. And we did a story about it this week, and there's a lot of suspicions that the Utah coal industry is somehow involved in that as a way to get their coal shipped through a remote port, Humboldt Bay, to Asia. But there'll be more on that in the next week or two.
Check out that story from Brian Maffley. It's really compelling and interesting. And then, George, I'll let you have a final say, and I'll skip mine. Oh, George, you're muted. Well,
I'm never muted. Check out the New Mormon Land on SL Trib. It talks about how the 9/11 is not just the attack on the World Trade Centers; it's also the anniversary of the Mountain Meadows Massacre, which is a huge event in Utah history. And it is also 9/11 is also the anniversary of the 1973 coup in Chile that brought down a democratically elected government,
right?
And has Henry Kissinger's fingerprints all over it.
Salvatore Allende. All right, George Pyle, Jessica Miller, Brian Maffley, all of the Tribune. Thanks for joining me today.
Yeah, Roger. See ya.
And we're going to turn now to my conversation with Brian Schott, Tribune political correspondent, about a recently surfaced video where Utah Senate President Stuart Adams points to the impact of a star basketball player on the conversation around critical race theory at the legislature. Brian Schott, political correspondent with the Tribune. Thanks for making time for this.
Sure.
To start with, I'm just going to play 45 seconds of a clip of Senate President Stuart Adams, and then I'll ask you to tell us some of the context behind his statement. But we will begin with that clip.
Sure.
We copied Minnesota's abortion bill. I think we've joined in your lawsuit. And so Mississippi's bill, and we've joined with them in their lawsuit. I mentioned during the general session, we passed resolution trying to ban critical race theory because the governor wouldn't put it on our call yesterday. We did it as a resolution. I just got a text last night, and I hate to use names, but I will. Donovan Mitchell is not happy with us. And you start to get very popular sports stars like that are pushing back. We've got work to do to try to educate him. And my text back was, let's get after him and let's go tell him what we're doing, because they don't really think he understands what happened. But it is a problem. It's not something that we've seen a lot in Utah, but I think it is a big issue, and we're going to deal with it.
So, Brian, again, Utah Senate President Stuart Adams there. Where and when did he say this?
This was at a conference back in May. And he speaks a lot, especially since he's the national president of ALEC. There were some members of ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, on the panel that he was with. And this was in response to a question about how state governments, if they're getting any blowback from corporations, companies for quote unquote woke culture, which is something that I hate. I hate that term, but are they getting any blowback from that? And people started talking about abortion laws. The person who spoke right before Adams was from the Mississippi legislature, and their anti-abortion bill is up for review at the Supreme Court, and it could overturn Roe v. Wade. And Adams, in that clip, says that that Utah copied their bill. At first, he says Minnesota, but then he mentions Mississippi, and so that's the reference there to that abortion bill. And then he tries to bring in the fight over critical race theory. Now, you'll remember back in May, there was a special session that the governor called. They were dealing with a bunch of federal money to come in that was on its way because of the COVID relief programs, and lawmakers had to accept the money and then start spending it. And there were a couple of groups that wanted some bills put on the call to that special session. One was to ban critical race theory in schools. The other one was to declare Utah a Second Amendment sanctuary. Now, the governor declined to put those on the call, which upset a lot of people, a lot of the Republicans in the legislature. So the House and the Senate called their own extraordinary sessions, which they were in independent, and then they passed a resolution against the teaching of critical race theory. What they actually said was they wanted the state school board to come up with standards, you know, that no race should be put above another in classroom instruction. Nobody should be made to feel bad about their heritage and so on and so forth. And so that's what Adams is talking about there. And then he said that jazz star Donovan Mitchell didn't understand what they did. And he's referring to those resolutions, which is kind of an inelegant way of putting it. It was kind of a roundabout way to get to the point that he was trying to make.
And the point he was trying to make was that Donovan Mitchell how does Utah jazz star Donovan Mitchell play into all of this? He wasn't happy, I guess, or expressed some displeasure about the fact that the legislature had passed these resolutions. Is that correct?
Yeah, he had expressed some displeasure. This was also round about the time that GQ magazine, the Tribune, actually reported that Donovan Mitchell was going to get involved in a number of social justice issues. And then GQ magazine said that there was a group of NBA players, coaches, and owners who were forming a coalition. They had hired a lobbyist group, and they were learning how to go to state houses and advocate for this sort of thing. So they're getting involved with this. They're using their money and their access to get involved in politics. And if you know anything about Donovan Mitchell, and I have not covered him extensively, but he is very aware of social justice issues. When the NBA had their COVID bubble in Orlando, when they started the season back up, he showed up at the very first game of the season wearing a bulletproof vest that had the names of Black men and women who had been killed by the police. And so if you don't understand where he's coming from in his social issues, or at least his stance on social issues, that's all you need to know. Okay, so I'm sure that he was at loggerheads with the members of the legislature because he didn't like what they were doing wading into this. Now, the really newsy part of this to me is when Adams admits at the end of the clip that this is that the critical race theory, we don't see it that much here in the state, but they're still going to do it. So that just tells me that this is going to be a real cynical thing that they're doing for political advantage in the 2022 session.
Right. And that's going to happen. I mean, he says that despite the fact that it's not a problem, he says that he admits it, as you just said, in Utah schools, lawmakers are going to try and ban it anyway. And that's on the agenda for this next legislative session, Brian?
Well, there are some bill files out there. I know Representative Steve Christiansen, who was going to sponsor whatever legislation was going to be in that special session about critical race theory. He was going to sponsor that. I have spoken with him. He has a bill file. He doesn't really want to say much about it, but he does talk about wanting to ban the teaching of divisive topics in schools. Now that I've talked to so many people and they're just like, that is completely unenforceable because math could be seen as a divisive topic. But you've seen this sort of thing happen when the state school board was looking at standards for teaching equity and inclusion and diversity in classes. Natalie Klein had a list of like 100 phrases she wanted to ban teachers from saying. And, you know, that also, it is just astonishing the lengths that people who purport to be conservative will go to use state power to enforce a way of thinking or enforce a way of acting. And that those aren't the conservatives that I grew up with.
Brian, I'm wondering if you might just do us the favor of reminding us basically what it is that critical race theory is and why Republicans are up in arms about it.
Well, okay, it's a tough question. Critical race theory came up in the 1970s, and it is an advanced academic concept that basically postulates that the history of the United States is inextricably linked with racism, and there are institutions in this country that may not be racist now, but they were racist, and there were policies that were started based on racism, such as redlining in real estate, and these policies are contributing to systemic racism. The best line that I've ever heard about this is, if your 10-year-old is learning about critical race theory, you should be ecstatic because that means that they're in law school. That's pretty much the only place that this stuff is taught. Now, there has been a real cynical effort by some on the right wing to conflate critical race theory with any discussion of race, any discussion of equity. And that's what got this group, a group here in the state called Utah Parents United. They led the fight against masking in schools, and then they have quickly pivoted and are now leading the fight against critical race theory in schools. And they are all whipped up because there was a presentation, and they've got this on their website, given by a diversity specialist from the Utah State School Board to some charter school administrators that talked about equity and inclusion in schools and how you might go about doing that. And that caused an absolute moral panic, saying that they are now teaching kids that they are racist. And really, a lot of this argument is so bad faith. If you go to their website, because they this group who has refused every single interview request that I've ever given them, I don't know if anyone at the Tribune has ever spoken to them. They just completely ignore it. But they breathlessly talk about all these testimonials from parents they have on their website about how the horrible things that teachers are teaching them in schools. And it's my son had to write an essay about slavery, you know, or my son had to write an essay about why Colin Kaepernick is being discriminated against. And the teacher didn't like his counter argument. And so he got a bad grade, you know, and what has happened is the real cynical ploy is there are some national groups, and NBC News has done some real great reporting on this. There is a national group that basically parachutes into places, helps these groups opposed to critical race theory get up and going, and then they just cause this huge uproar. And the person who's involved with that group, his name is escaping me right now, but he has said, and there is a tweet going around there and it's deleted, that they want to conflate everything with critical race theory. Everything is critical race theory, and it can include whatever. So this argument can just go on. It's a real cynical ploy. It's putting teachers on the defensive. And I've spoken to teachers here in the state. They are worried that kids are going to be in the classroom. And we actually saw it earlier this year. Teachers start saying something, out come the cell phones. And then the videos are now this teacher down in Alpine went over the line. You know, I mean, that was way over the line what she did. But that's just going to create a really, really bad situation.
And Brian, I just want to know if there's a difference. I mean, so Senator Adams has this comment in your article talking about those resolutions and saying that, you know, the things that they banned in these resolutions are that no curriculum or instruction materials should include that one race is inherently superior or inferior to another, that an individual should be discriminated against or receive adverse treatment because of the individual's race, or that an individual's moral character is determined by the individual's race. Is any of that, you know, critical race theory?
No, it's not. Okay. And what this is, the resolutions passed by lawmakers were basically instructions to the Utah State School Board saying, come up with standards based on these ideas, on these three tenets. They didn't say anything about critical race theory, but that's what it did. And the school board did this, right? And there was a hearing in the last interim where the school board came up and explained what they did, and legislators seemed reasonably satisfied with what they did. So that ended it for now. It's going to flare back up. People will show up again. You know, right now, all the heat is around masks in schools again, masks and mask mandate. So that's where everyone has sort of shifted the outrage machine. It'll come back around to this. You know, there are proposals in other states to put cameras in classrooms to make sure the teachers aren't teaching things that parents object to. You know, I actually covered this issue when the Utah State GOP was considering a resolution against critical race theory. And one woman who got up to speak against it said that she was a lawyer who worked in public education for a while. And she said that when she was a school administrator, there were parents who had adopted Black children who had come to them and said, we don't want you to teach anything about racism because we don't want our daughter to feel bad. They literally didn't want their child to find out about racism. And, you know, the internet is a thing. It exists. I mean, you're not going to be able to keep that child away from the internet. It's going to show up, you know. So it's all bad faith all the way around.
Well, Brian, well, and I guess we'll look for a kind of showdown in January, depending upon what happens with the attempt to ban critical race theory, and we'll look to your coverage for that. Brian Schott is political correspondent with the Salt Lake Tribune, and I really appreciate your making time for this today.
Thanks.
And again, that's Tribune political correspondent Brian Schott. You can check out his article on this and also find everything else that we've been covering on the show over at sltrib.com. And that does it for our show today. Behind the Headlines is a co-production of the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. Podcasts are available over at kcpw.org. I'm Roger McDonough. Have a great weekend. Looks to be less smoky this weekend, by the way. Join us again next week. We'll be right back. Check, check.